About twice a year, I embarrass this man across the Atlantic by praising him so highly that it takes him about half a year to recuperate. From the laugh, I guess you recuperate faster than I than I'm assuming. He is Paul Johnson, one of the absolute eminent thinkers and historians living on this planet at this time. And I don't want to gush beyond that lest I overwhelm all of us, but it's truly, I think everybody knows my voice, or my listeners do, an honor for me to always have you on. And you've now written yet another wonderful book, George Washington, the Founding Father, and I always love it when you write about American topics because you bring to it the outsider's clarity and yet a deep love and admiration for the American experiment. Is that a fair way of explaining you and America?
Well, yes, I think it is. You see, my publishers in New York said to me, we discover young people today don't know enough about George Washington. And we think the reason is that the books about Washington are so long, many of them in multi-volume shape. Do you think you could do George Washington for us in 40,000 words? So I agreed to do it, and I did it, and this is the book.
I might add, forgive me for this, because this is one of my standing on a chair and just screaming my guts out, but I believe that is a major problem. Length of books has been a major problem in alienating people from required information for some time now. And you're right, there is a 7-volume, I believe it is, and it's a magisterial work by Flexner, 7 volumes on George Washington. But outside of a handful of academics, I don't know who will read that. And we need those books. But we need somebody to make him accessible in, as you put it, 40,000 words, which is how many pages? What does that
come
to?
Well, it's 120 pages.
Yeah, that's great. That's what that should almost be required. Now, first of all, I'll ask you about that length. Was it hard to do in 120 pages?
Well, I've done a number of such books. I've done Napoleon at the same length, and mm-hmm. I've done a little book on the Renaissance. And I find it can be done, and I've got quite a skillful at it. I mean, I've written a number of books of over 1,000 pages.
Right.
And they are very hard work. But some of these short books are great fun to write because the shortage of space you're given forces you
That's
to think
right.
very sharply.
That's right. Exactly right. I so believe in that. Now, why did you take on the task of George Washington? It wasn't merely to be of service to the young American who or other who doesn't know about him. Do you?
Well, admiration, really. You see, I think America has been a very lucky country, both in the country that God gave them and the men God gave them when they were founded. But above all, I think they were lucky in Washington. And I don't think there can have been many men in world history who both proved themselves to be a first-class general and then a first-class statesman. And curiously enough, when he had rendered all his services as a general and proposed to return to his estates, his old enemy, George III, said to the president of the Royal Academy, who was an American, what do you think General Washington will do now? And the president of the Academy said, he will return to his estates. And George III said, if he does that, he will be the greatest man alive. Because the equivalent in English history, Oliver Cromwell, had gone on to become a kind of military dictator. George Washington was too humble and too constitutional-minded to do that. He returned to his estates and waited to be summoned by Congress.
Hmm. Why are we so lucky to have had him? Is that the primary reason? Because
well, that, I think, is the fact that he was a general who then went on to be a first-class constitutional leader, president, it is the first double reason. But the second reason, I think, was that he was also typical of the best kind of American in making the fullest possible use of his opportunities. He inherited quite large estates, and he received many more by virtue of his wife and through his own endeavors. But he went on to develop them. And this is a side of Washington which I think is not sufficiently known. He was one of the greatest farmers America has ever had, and by the end of his life was one of the richest men in the country. But he'd done this by hard work in developing his estates using the very latest methods and instruments of agricultural science.
What do we know about him personally? What sort of
man? We know a great deal in one sense, that he left more papers than anyone else of his time. And they're all there in the National Archives and in the Library of
Congress. Papers in what?
Personal papers from diaries from the age of 14.
He kept
every letter he sent or received. So, I mean, in that sense, he's very well documented. But in another sense, he's a very elusive man. He didn't easily unbend. He's a difficult man to work out the psychology he possessed and so forth. And he baffled a lot of his contemporaries.
Well, how did he baffle them? In what way did he baffle them? Because of what?
Well, they couldn't quite make him out. Some of them, those closest to him, particularly those who fought with him in the war, thought he was a very great man. They were very clear on that, that he was a good man and a great man and a very intelligent man. Others, such as his vice president, John Adams, underrated him. Hmm. Adams thought he was a very foolish fellow who'd been extremely lucky and had managed to survive more by bluff than by great intelligence or ability, and he tended to ridicule him and so forth.
Sounds
and
like
I suppose others did that. But the truth of the matter is he was a man of very great ability.
Was he a man of great intellect?
I wouldn't say intellect in the sense that he was not an intellectual. He wasn't interested in ideas. He was interested in practicalities. But he had a library of 750 books, which was quite a lot for those days. And I think he'd read most of them. He'd certainly consulted all of them.
Was he a religious man?
Not particularly. I mean, he was a religious man for social reasons. He attended his church and he sat on the local governing board and so on. But he was not a man who automatically went to church every Sunday. He did as a rule, but by no means automatically.
Was he a believing...
And I don't think that his nature was a very spiritual one. If anything... he was a very conscientious Freemason. Masonry was an important part of his life.
As it was for many of the leaders, interestingly.
Indeed, yes.
Yes.
Yes. But I would say that he was typical of his time in that the late 18th century was a very secular age. It wasn't a spiritual age.
And yet he invoked God in his inaugural address.
Yes, he invoked God in both senses. He invoked God for rhetorical reasons and also for cursing reasons. he would say things like to his cabinet when they made life difficult for him, "By God, sirs, I will retire to my estates if you're not careful."
Oh, and then that somehow... ticked off the more religious. It was felt that he had used God's name in vain.
Yes.
Yeah. Was he a believing Christian? Would you say that?
Oh, I'm sure he was. And he was a believing Christian. He believed in God and in Christ. But he also believed that religion was an extremely important force in life. It was a form of social control. It made people better than they would be otherwise, and therefore more easily governed and better citizens. He took what you might call a pragmatic view of religion.
I'm speaking to Paul Johnson, and everything he writes is self-recommending. I mean, if he wrote a history of rhododendrons, I would have him on. But this is about, of course, the father of our country, George Washington, the founding father. It's just 120 pages, distilled wisdom. We will return, and if you'd like to speak to Paul Johnson, here's a rare opportunity, 1-8-PRAGER-776, The Dennis Prager Show. All righty, y'all, you're listening to The Dennis Prager Show. My guest is the eminent, if not preeminent, historian, writer, thinker of our time, Paul Johnson. And his latest book is George Washington. It's 120 pages. It's a series called Eminent Lives. It's an important series, and it's a very important book. And if you, like me, don't have the time to read many books that are very long, this is perfect as an introduction or a summary of George Washington's life. 1-8-PRAGER-776, if you'd like to ask some questions. What is your take on George Washington and the issue of slavery?
Well, George Washington, like many Virginian gentlemen, had a lot of slaves. But he also disapproved of slavery, and the last years of his life were spent in devising means whereby he could free his slaves. Of course, other people did this or wanted to do, like Jefferson planned to release his slaves, but his debts were so great that he couldn't do it, and when Jefferson died, all the slaves were sold down the river and their families split up. Now, Washington didn't have debts, or very few, because he was very prudent about money. So under his will, the slaves were eventually freed, and that was almost unique at the time, I think. So that's my take on his view of slavery. He thought that slavery was inefficient and wicked.
And wicked.
And wicked, yes.
Mm-hmm. Did Jefferson think it was wicked?
He said so, yes, he certainly said so, but he got himself into such financial difficulties mm-hmm. that he was never able to do anything about it, unfortunately.
This is just a bit on a tangent, but I had reported recently of a school, understandably in Berkeley, California, and I'm sure you know of its reputation, that had now voted to change its name from Jefferson High School to another name because Jefferson owned slaves. Why would you respond to those to the people who recommend
well,
that?
I think that's unhistorical because in Jefferson's day, someone from his social and geographical background would have owned slaves. And it's to Jefferson's credit that he wanted to end the institution. Unfortunately, he wasn't able to do it in his case because he spent too much money on books and on architecture. But I don't think it's right to hand that against him. And I think Jefferson had many other great qualities which played a very, very important part in the history of America, in the founding mm-hmm. and the history of America. And there wouldn't, without Jefferson, without people like Washington, there wouldn't be a Berkeley University today.
Right, that's correct, but they don't want to acknowledge that. 1-8-PRAGER-776, and let's go to Irvine, California, and Joe. Hello, Joe, you're on with Paul Johnson and Dennis Prager.
Hi, Dennis. Hi, Mr. Johnson. Hi. Mr. Johnson, I heard an anecdote that during the Continental Congress, Washington would show up every day wearing his general's uniform, and then when he was appointed president or leader, he was, oh, you mean me? And he was kind of campaigning through his uniform. Any truth to that?
Oh, boy, I see the problem here.
Or rather, wearing his uniform. He wasn't then a general. But he was entitled to do that because he had rendered great services already in the field. And what is more, he wanted to make the point that if necessary, the 13 states had to go to war against Britain. He was in uniform to prove it. So it wasn't anything frivolous, and it wasn't egotistical. It was he was a practical man, and this was a practical gesture.
This may be sacrilegious to some, but in your description, I was wondering if an analogy in any way to Ronald Reagan would be appropriate?
Well, he had certain things in common with Reagan. George Washington had three or four very simple, clear ideas about his duty, and he pushed them for all they were worth. I think Mr. Reagan was a similar character. He also had three or four fundamental ideas about life and politics and pushed them for all they were worth. And, of course, that often makes a very successful politician.
That and when you spoke of John Adams' dismissal of him, it reminded me immediately of many of those who dismissed Ronald Reagan, and that's what brought that to mind.
Yes, because Ronald Reagan was not an intellectual, nor was George Washington.
Right.
But then in my experience, going back over 50 years and covering a lot of countries, intellectuals do not make good, successful politicians.
Right, or leaders. Yeah,
leaders.
I mean, because people might say, well, of course not politicians because they pander, but I mean, they're just not great leaders.
They're not usually good
politicians
either.
Also, religiously, it sounds similar. They're both God-centered, believing Christians, but not terribly overtly religious.
Yes, that's true. But they both, I think, believed that Christianity was absolutely essential for the American nation, and that it made a much better nation in consequence.
That's exactly right. Now, did people in Washington's time know they were with greatness?
Sorry, did they?
Did they know that they were in the presence of greatness?
Oh, I think there's absolutely no doubt about that. Washington traveled over most of what was then the United States, and everywhere he was greeted. He was greeted both as the hero of the Revolutionary War, but also as the President of the United States and as a great man. And I think nobody who was ever in his presence left it without feeling he'd been with a great man, who was also a simple man.
What was his family life like? In other words, vis-a-vis his parents and his wife?
Well, he had no children.
Right, that's why I said it that way.
His mother was very important, much more so than his father. His wife was very important. He had no children, but he had a lot of children who were closely related to him. And he used to have them at Mount Vernon. They were very delighted to go because Mount Vernon was a magical place then, as indeed it still is today. So he was always surrounded by young people, and they loved him because he was kind to them. He enjoyed their company. He liked them. He took them out riding with him or on the river. He was a paterfamilias, even though he had no children of his own.
Would he be surprised at how great America became?
No, because that's what he thought America had. Now, he lived half a century before the phrase manifest destiny was coined. But in a sense, he was a precursor of that. The real reason why he broke with Britain and thought it was essential that America should take the sword against Britain was because Britain, in his view, was going to thwart this manifest destiny by forbidding the American states to expand beyond the Alleghenies to go into the Mississippi Valley the Great Plains.
We continue in a moment. Paul Johnson, the book, George Washington. I'm Dennis Prager. George Washington is the subject, and my guest is Paul Johnson. One of the great thinkers and historians of our time has just written a 120-page book. And I love those books because it means that every word matters. George Washington, the Founding Father. And it is a wonderful way to introduce yourself or to get the insights of a great thinker about George Washington. It'll be up at the DennisPrager.com website. The phone number to speak to Paul Johnson, who is in London, is 1-8-PRAGER-776, 1-8-PRAGER-776. When Washington took over as general, did he believe he'd win?
I think he did, because what he thought was that he had only to keep the army in being and the government in being long enough for the British to lose heart. He felt that time was on his side, so he didn't mind too much if he met with physical reverses, lost battles or skirmishes, or had to retreat, so long as he could keep the army together and keep the congressional government protected and in being. He knew that the 13 states would win in the end. So I think he was a very cautious optimist.
Now, you were saying, because this subject has always fascinated me, what exactly were Americans rebelling against?
They thought they were conservatives who were resisting innovation. And this was particularly what George Washington himself thought. He believed, as did most Americans, that they had had a form of self-government right from the beginning in the early 17th century. In other words, they'd had it for the best part of two centuries, and that they were entitled to go on governing themselves and raising taxes as they thought fit. They thought that the British government was the aggressor. That was the force which was trying to upset things, to bring about a revolution, to limit their liberties and remove their rights. So they were the, as it were, the constitutional force. They were the conservative force, and the British were the usurpers and the aggressors. That gave them a great sense of moral self-righteousness, which was extremely important in holding them together and making them fight.
And what did the British believe? Was it moral self-righteousness or simply this is our imperial domain and we're not going to let it leave?
No, the British were divided. George III and his ministers felt that they had an absolute right over their colonial subjects. The word subject is very important. They felt they had absolute rights. But there were a great many other English politicians, such as Edmund Burke, who thought that was quite wrong, and their sympathies were fundamentally with the colonists, with the rebels, as they were called, because they saw that they admitted most of the American case. So the British were divided from the beginning, and they became more divided the longer the war lasted. And George Washington was proved right that in the end, the British would lose heart, and of course they did.
Mm-hmm. We'll continue on that in a moment. There's something I've always wondered about, and I have no idea if we know the answer to this. Why don't all Americans talk like you do?
Why don't all Americans talk like I do?
Yeah.
Because Americans tended to talk like English people did in the early 17th
That's
century.
That's right, exactly. Why did it change?
Both as they were more conservative in the war, so they're more conservative in the way they pronounce the English language. That's my theory, anyway.
So you mean Americans deliberately changed their accent?
No, I'm saying that Americans had the original American accent, was the English accent,
yes, exactly,
of the early 17th century, and they kept it because they were so conservative. It was the English who changed.
Oh, you mean I speak like your ancestors spoke?
We developed more quickly in terms of changing our accent. The Americans stuck to the original ones.
I've never heard that. That is fascinating.
I believe that to be true.
So you believe that I speak more like a 17th century Englishman than you do?
Yes, exactly.
Wow, that's absolute
and
revelation.
So do most Americans.
Yes, no, obviously, yes. That is so interesting. We'll be back in a moment. I asked the right man. We're going to take your calls. A, it's a rare opportunity to speak to such a thinker. Secondly, it's about George Washington. Whatever is on your mind on that subject, 1-8-PRAGER-776. I cannot commend the book too highly. Paul Johnson's George Washington, the Founding Father, a 120-page understanding of the man. We'll be back in a moment on the Dennis Prager Show. All righty, everybody. You're listening to the Dennis Prager Show. Appreciate it very much. My guest is Paul Johnson. He's in London, and his latest book is George Washington. It's part of a series of Eminent Lives. It's 120 pages, exactly the size I love, and by such a man, it's just imperative reading. We're talking about George Washington here. What do we know about his relationship to Martha?
Well, it seems to have been pretty good on the whole. He wrote to her constantly, whenever he possibly can. And, of course, she came up when the army was in winter quarters. She came up and brought some ladies with her, and that made a huge difference to the morale of the army, because they got a touch of domesticity there, and they were able to enjoy what they were missing back in their homes. So I think Martha was an exemplary wife. She was a woman of wide sympathies, great warmth of character, and she made Washington an excellent wife. And I don't think, probably being the man he was, he could have done so well without her. In fact, I'm sure he couldn't.
That's a beautiful testimony. Did not having children, did he ever express himself on that fact?
No, he never did. And I think it must have gone very hard with him, because if you're a great farmer, as well as a great statesman and general, and you amass a large estate, which you've created largely by your own efforts and intelligence, not to be able to pass it on is a great deprivation, particularly as he adorned it with this beautiful house.
Yep. Very interesting that you would infer that, though, but he was silent on the matter.
He never complained about it. Mm-hmm. It was the decision of Providence, and he accepted it just as he accepted all the good things he'd enjoyed in life.
All right, let's get some of the callers here. And we begin in Van Nuys, California, with Gregory, Dennis Prager, and Paul Johnson. Hi.
Good morning, Mr. Prager and Mr. Johnson. A question I've always wanted to find out. How aware was the English crown of Washington's emergence as a leader? And also, did he ever have an ongoing correspondence with his British counterparts or his adversaries as the war was coming into its fruition?
No, he never corresponded with George III, of course. He did correspond with the British commanders because they wanted him to address him as Mr. Washington, and he insisted on being addressed as General Washington. Otherwise, he wouldn't receive their letters. That was part of his overall strategy of maintaining that he was the legitimate commander-in-chief of a legitimate government. So he wouldn't stand any nonsense of being called Mr. Washington. It was General Washington. Hmm. Otherwise, he would return the letter unopened. And that was very typical of the formality of his character, which actually rested upon sound, practical argument.
Talking about his character, I assume there's no truth to the cherry tree story.
No, none at all, so far as we know.
Okay, fine.
And a lot of there's a lot of legend about him. But the actual truth about his life is so intrinsically interesting. You don't need
right. You don't need legends.
Tree stuff.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Did he did he have siblings?
Yes, he came from quite a large family, and he took a great interest in his family and liked to think of where it came from in England and so forth. He was very much a family man, and he liked to sit with his family in the evening. After dinner, playing card games and so on, and being read to. And he created Mount Vernon so that it would be a family home.
All righty, let's continue here. And in Phoenix, it's Todd. Hello, Todd. Dennis Prager, Paul Johnson.
Oh, howdy. Hey, you know, I wanted to know, first off, Dennis, I love your show.
Thank you.
That it's conservative but positive.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Mr. Johnson, can you tell me, I'm going to hang up and listen on the radio. Can you tell me about his relationship with Lafayette? You know, did he see him as a peer or subordinate or what?
His relationship with whom?
Lafayette.
With Lafayette.
Lafayette. Well, he regarded Lafayette as a young follower. As commander-in-chief, as general of the American army, he built up a collection of staff officers who were his young men, and he chose them with great care, and he became very fond of him, of them, as they did of him. Lafayette he regarded as the younger generation from Europe, who were attracted by the ideals of liberty and independence, and he hoped would take those ideals back to their own countries and make them prosper there, which of course was true, particularly in the case of Lafayette. So he regarded both his staff officers, his young staff officers, among whom he included Lafayette, because Lafayette worked at his staff for a time, as the sons, the children he never had. There was a paternal affection in his attitude.
Did he have any strong American opposition?
Yes, certainly towards the end, particularly during his second term as president, there was an increasingly organized opposition. Now, Washington deplored this, not merely because it made it difficult for him to rule effectively, to conduct the government, but because he hated the party system. He regarded the development of party politics as one of the worst aspects of British political life, and he hated the idea that it would spread to America too. So he tended to have in his cabinet what he thought were the representatives of all strands of different opinion in the United States, and he thought that's what a cabinet should be. It should represent all thoughts. But towards the end of his second term, he found that that didn't really work in practice, and his government tended to become more homogenous. And, of course, within 10 years, the party system was operating in the United States at full blast. But Washington, in his own time, did his best to resist it. And try and keep party out of politics.
Well, all right, we return for a final segment with Paul Johnson and his latest book, George Washington, the Founding Father. I'm Dennis Prager. All righty, final segment with Paul Johnson and his book, George Washington, the Founding Father. Paul Johnson is one of the preeminent thinkers and historians of our time. And this book is 120 pages in a series of eminent lives. I'm going to check into that series. If they had you do Washington, I would love to see who else did whom. I am going to summarize the calls on a full board of calls, Paul Johnson. Let's see here. From Cleveland, Linda, is it true that Washington was visited by an angel who showed him the future? I've not heard about that.
No, nor have I, and I don't believe it.
Okay, fine. All righty. David in Los Angeles, might people like Churchill or Lincoln be exceptions to the idea that intellectuals don't make good leaders?
No, because Churchill was not an intellectual, nor was Lincoln. Intellectuals I define as people who think that ideas are more important than people. And that didn't apply to either Lincoln or Churchill, and it certainly didn't apply to Washington.
In Tarzana, California, Sherry, is it true that one of Washington's best assets was his ability to be silent and let people speak without interruption?
That's absolutely right. He knew when to hold his peace. He could be silent because he had great power and dignity in his person. One of his assets was that he was 6'3". Which was enormous by the standards of the late 18th century. So he towered above people. He didn't have to agitate for dignity. He didn't have to demand it. He just had it. He had a presence. So when he was silent, his silence spoke.
Okay, that's very interesting and a good thing to know. Larry in California, my seventh great uncle was John Andre the Spy. Was there a relationship between Washington and Andre?
Yes, that's a very complicated thing. I don't want to go into it. But, of course, there were spies. There were also deserters, and there were renegades. And I think it is a testimony to Washington's greatness that he dealt with all these various difficult people in such a way that as to leave no lasting stain on his honor. It's impossible to point to an incident where Washington was manifestly unfair or cruel. And I think, granted the difficulties of his position during a long war where his resources were very limited and his opponents were stronger and he was often forced to retreat or be defeated, that is an important testimony.
Thank you so much, Paul Johnson. Please keep writing for many years.
Thank you very much indeed.